Welcome to WRTI's Classical Stream, made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Learn more at WRTI.org.
We have a unique guest today, the ambassador of ragtime, Max Morath, a name that is probably known to people of a certain age, and you'll forgive me for saying that, Mr. Morath, but welcome to Crossover.
Thank you very much. I don't mind you saying that at all.
You are a legend, actually.
Well, I don't know about that word. I don't mind being an old guy because I'm not a sex symbol. So it doesn't make any difference.
Well, you don't look as though you've been around as long as you have, but nobody does these days because you are so active and you are doing just about everything under the sun that has to do with ragtime and, of course, bringing the word to the people and doing other things as well. And we'll talk about that today here
Thank
on Crossover. It's wonderful to have you here. You are actually working on a new project, aren't you?
Well, several, yeah. I'm working on a thing with William Balcom and Joan Morris that, believe it or not, is an opera, which might throw Morath into his opera debut pushing 80. But
why did you decide to write an opera?
Well, I didn't. It's Balcom and Morris, and Balcom and his librettist, Arnold Weinstein.
Yes.
But they are doing an operatic treatment of the old Robert Sherwood play, Idiot's Delight. And the lead character is over-the-hill vaudevillian who plays piano and is touring Europe with six blondes.
That sounds like you.
Typecasting! Anyway, I don't know that much more about it. But I'm also doing several other things, including peddling a musical that I've been working on for years based on the writings of the now-forgotten Finley Peter Dunn, whose character, Mr. Dooley, probably influenced editorially the political and foreign policy decisions of this country more than any other person, including Mark Twain. There's my spiel. And I've set a lot of his things to music. The man wrote columns that were read by millions of Americans for 20 years, but unfortunately wrote them in an Irish brogue. And when you read it today, you don't want to read it because it's just almost indecipherable. But the things he said marked Teddy Roosevelt's first two terms, marked our wars and our imperialistic ideas positively. This is the guy that said when somebody asked him if he was going to serve in the Spanish-American War, he says, "Whenever I'm called upon to fight for God and my country, I'd like to be sure the senior partner has been consulted first." And he's also the guy, and this comes up every time there's a big, major Supreme Court decision. They were arguing about whether, when we took over the Philippines, whether the Constitution would prevail in the Philippines. And the catchphrase was, "Would the Constitution follow the flag?" Somebody asked Mr. Dooley about that, and he says, "Well," he said, "whether the Constitution follows the flag or not, I don't know, but the Supreme Court follows the election returns." Hello, he said that in 1903.
What year was that? Yeah. Very, very, oh, fantastic.
So what I've done is taken all of these columns, essays, and dissolved them into dialogue because there are all these other characters in his saloon. He's a saloon keeper in Chicago. And he's talking to all these other guys, one of them Dr. O'Leary and Father Kelly and a couple of other characters, and I've turned that into dialogue. So it's one of the things that I'm working on. You speak of new projects and you punch my new project button.
Well, what's so incredible is, if we backtrack for our audience as well, where you started, how you started, how you evolved into who you are, as we all evolve, but professionally and, of course, artistically, you're probably in a different place than when you started. You were a radio announcer, weren't you?
I was a kid radio announcer. I couldn't believe it. I was still in high school. I got a job when I was 17 working at a CBS station in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Did you want to be an announcer? Or was this a
well,
dream?
Well, no, I didn't. It was a job, and it paid better than mowing lawns.
Oh, well.
And I was terrible. I'm sure I was just awful. But there was a shortage of men around at that time due to WW2.
Yes.
And so I thought I'd died and gone to heaven, and I began to sound like a radio announcer. You know, it's a style, it's a technique.
It gets to you, yeah.
Yeah. And that led me into deciding to go into broadcasting, and I worked in television out west and gee, I don't want to do all that. I've had good luck doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I'm working in jazz clubs and then working in the mountains out in Colorado and Arizona doing melodrama.
But you didn't start as a musician. Were you playing the piano?
Oh, I was playing the piano. I really kind of picked up a jazz style. I was a pretty good jazz player, and I picked...
But did you study, or did you just kind of sit
down? I studied a little bit, not enough.
Not.
I took some private lessons in harmony and theory at the college there, because I was in high school trying to write arrangements for a band, and they sounded horrible, so I went to this wonderful guy and took some lessons in basic harmony, mm-hmm. which helped me a lot. I finally understood why the five
why you were doing the things
the
you were
chord,
doing,
you know?
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then I've been pretty lucky, Jill. I just kind of went from one job to the next, and I've had a lot of help along the way from various people in the business, and was able to do a combination of broadcasting and theater and music and composition and commercials.
But you actually, again, you actually were turned on by ragtime, I think, at one point. That must have been the thing that inspired
well,
you.
Well, let me tell you, the thing about ragtime, and let me make a couple of disclaimers first. I think a lot of your listeners associate quite properly the word ragtime with the recent, in the last 25 years, rediscovery, so to speak, of the music of Scott Joplin,
right.
who was, no question, the leader in the pianistic approach to ragtime.
Yes.
And one of the things I find when I do my shows is that people therefore expect that I'm going to do an evening of piano rags concert. No. In the first place, I don't think it's that interesting. And in the second place, I wouldn't expect people, unless they're predisposed, to enjoy that.
But I will tell you, it starts your toe tapping.
It does.
Makes you feel good.
I'll tell you this, for instance, is the major contradiction, and I insert this as a subtext in every show that I do. Everything I've been able to find out about this music, which was America's first popular music and existed for 20 years, is more about vocal music than it is about piano music, and it's more about dance. Piano was the introductory salient, which said syncopate.
Right. Okay.
Stay in 2/4, stay in duple time, keep a left hand that is staying in time, and syncopate your right hand against it. And the early rags were marches, syncopated marches. And the piano players sort of led the way, but at the same time, singers and dancers and bands were beginning to inflect syncopation.
Now, what years are you talking about?
Well, I like to say that the ragtime years lasted roughly from around the time of the early Chicago World's Fair, 1892, 1893, about to the time of World War I, when, of course, the new thing came along. The kids were now playing a thing called jazz.
Yes.
And another thing I always find so interesting, Jill, is that, and it shouldn't surprise us, but it does, I remind audiences peripherally in the shows that I do that they're listening to the music of a bunch of kids. It's easy to think of all of these people, Scott Joplin, Hubie Blake, Irving Berlin, Burt Williams, as old-timers. Wrong. They were like the kids today. Popular music always has belonged to the youngsters. The breakthroughs, the changes,
the innovators,
the Beatles,
yeah, right. mm-hmm.
the bands of the 30s, you name it. It all started with youngsters. Kids, I mean, we're talking. Hubie Blake went into his first professional job at 14.
Yes,
down in Baltimore.
Well, they were.
Scott Joplin left home and went on the road when he was 15. Irving Berlin had his first hit when he was 18, I think. And I think it's important to realize that they had that same...
The fire in their
belly.
Yeah,
exactly,
yes.
The passion
right.
to say this is something new.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough. They were contradicted not only by the usual things in the business, meaning financial problems,
yes.
but by race.
Of course.
Led by, as George M. Cohan, the great George M. Cohan, who was Irish, said if it weren't for the blacks, the Jews, and the Irish, there wouldn't be any such thing as popular music, because it was that striving. And I think that's important. Musically aside, it has to do with why it happened and still happening. See, that's what's amazing to me. We're still going through that incredible, complex, chaotic thing we call popular music.
You're listening to Crossover, and our guest today is Max Mareth. So who is doing it now? The young people are doing it, but is it so ethnic?
Well, it's ethnic in a different sense. easy answer to your question is I don't know, because I don't think anybody knew very much about Scott Joplin in 1915, and I don't think anybody predicted that Irving Berlin would prove to be our greatest songwriter when he was 22 years old. So I don't know. I can tell you this. I would bet you as we speak that somewhere, maybe not even in the United States, somewhere our Mozart is working right now.
Why did it come back? Why did you bring it back?
I didn't bring it back.
Started with, was it Joshua Rifkin that?
Well,
book,
Rifkin did
that
those
area.
Wonderful albums.
Yeah.
No, I always say when, and I'm asked that, Joplin brought it back. He was sitting there waiting to be rediscovered. No, it's true. There was a nice body of work that nobody knew about. The man had one hit, only one hit. The Maple Leaf Rag. Which was a blockbuster and started the whole thing. But all his other beautiful rags and his rhythmic things and his two operas.
Well, they were failure, too.
Nobody knew anything about him. And so the music was there waiting to be rediscovered. Well, that happens in this business. It happens in literature, too, and in painting, you know. Oh, who's this painter? Oh, my gosh, it's beautiful.
Oh, yes, but this was a trip. This was such an enormous movement. This thing happened. I remember it because all of a sudden, everything was ragtime. I mean, they were playing this, and you were very, very important.
Well, and of course, the big thing was that in 1974, we had that wonderful movie, The Sting.
Yes, for The Entertainer. Yeah.
With The Entertainer.
Right.
No, I'm not going to play
two hands.
No, I'm not going to do it because everybody wants to hear it. And you know that piece, and you'll be interested in this, you're a musician, that piece for years, and may still be this way because I checked with some publishers a few years back, that piece became the leading teaching piece for kids. Because in the first place, it's written in the key of C.
So there are no accidentals. Yeah.
And it fits under small hands. It begs to be played by kids.
The other thing is, though, that the ragtime was slow. Joplin's music was supposed to be played really at a casual, slower pace.
Yeah, maybe. See, I think this. My answer to that question, people say, is ragtime fast or slow? And the answer is yes. Because don't forget, ragtime also was show-off music.
Yes.
It was, these pianists were unbelievably technically skilled. The U.B. Blakes, the James P. Johnsons.
Oh, that left hand is impossible.
And when they'd play, they wanted to intimidate you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it
with
was.
With technique.
It was
and
like
they
a
did.
Challenge dance.
Exactly. Yeah. Jelly Roll Morton. But yes, a lot of Joplin's things, in the first place, by the way, one of the reasons I think they're more accessible is because they're not so difficult. They're not as difficult as sitting down to Jelly Roll Morton or James P. Johnson. They're accessible.
I think that I had heard that these, James P. Johnson and Jelly Roll, were really, those were the, I think they said the Atlantic City Boys or something. They were northerners, and they were really show-offs. And
well, yeah,
was
and
still much
also,
earlier.
They were
yeah.
also just remarkable musicians. The Joplin style ragtime is a Midwestern style and began to emerge around St. Louis at the turn of the century, and there were a number of other players out there too, a couple of whom I do in my show, a fellow by the name of Jimmy Scott out of Kansas City. But you see, here again, I don't want to make it sound like this is all piano music. It's not. I do a lot of the vaudeville songs and the things that the syncopation, the offbeatness of ragtime infected and illuminated vocal music too. And also, by the way, and there's no way to document this, but I can tell you for sure that the advent of ragtime, which was considered scurrilous, immoral, offbeat, against the laws of religion,
yes, of course,
on and on, brought vernacular into the music, the popular songs, brought slang, brought street language. Vaudevillians and comedians of every stripe composed parodies lampooning the hypocrisy of people in every walk of life. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they all got the needle, except entertainers, because it's widely known that there's not an ounce of hypocrisy in any of us.
And
no, because we admit.
And they're so respected.
Yes. And we admit to being rogues and vagabonds, philanderers, liberals. But except for us, the usual suspects were rounded up. To make my point there about the fact that this term ragtime, which became kind of a symbolic and generic, I don't know for sure, it didn't have a musical meaning by then. And it freed everybody up to do things that they hadn't done before. 10 years before that, we were singing like British Music Hall. We were singing on the beat. We used legitimate voices, popular music. You listen to the old recordings. Those were legit voices singing right on the beat. Mm-hmm. And then they began to think, wait a minute, I don't have to do that anymore. I can mess around. I can, and of course, that's the basis of style. Somebody today in popular music or anywhere else sang right on the beat, we'd think, what's wrong with them?
Well, actually, though, also times changed, I think. And of course, you know, the mores changed and the limitations weren't as, you know, stringent.
And so true.
I think, but that's what goes on and on and on. Of course, now we're in a situation where people are still complaining about that. But that's exactly what happened with jazz, I think, and with that syncopation and the change of music and the style of singing. Absolutely.
Well,
and
I,
then vaudeville, of course.
I often say when people say, what's ragtime? I say, what isn't? That is, as long as it syncopates, we kept changing the names, rock and roll, hip-hop,
but
bebop,
it's
funk, jazz.
I mean, it's really different. What I am so amazed with, I listen to, you have some albums out that are really wonderful, and of course
Thank you.
Have one that is something called Jonah...
Jonah Man.
Man. And there is a song on there, I swear that Cab Calloway sang Minnie the Moocher and Willie the Weeper is the same thing.
It's kind of the same tune.
And it's the kind of the feel is the same. Of course, the subject matter is different.
Cab Calloway's version of it was fun. And my recording of it's about drugs.
Serious.
It's about the
drugs.
Use of drugs. And
I
how
just,
it'll
when
kill
I,
you.
When I started listening to that, I said, wow, I know that, but I didn't know it.
Just yesterday, I bought a copy of a magazine which is called American Legacy and is aimed at the African American population. And the cover story is about Burt Williams.
Oh, yes.
And that album is about Burt Williams. And I noticed that there was a big piece in the Times, New York Times, just a month or so ago, about the fact that a lot of Williams, who is acknowledged to be probably, in the first place, the most successful African-American entertainer of his time, if not one who changed the whole course of that kind of performance, pantomime, singing, and so forth. And a lot of his early recordings, most of them on Columbia 78s, have been re-released as such. And I'm convinced that Burt Williams, as an actor and singer, probably was as influential as Scott Joplin was as a pianist, and begs to be hailed, rediscovered.
Yes, and also I think he was also a victim of the times, and so he couched his I guess intelligence and sarcasm and irony in this mask that he had to put on, this black face, this minstrel kind of.
It's hard to believe that clear into the 1920s, black performers still blacked up.
That is very interesting.
It's
I was unaware.
So
of that.
Painful and so tragic and so unbelievable that you think, what? Oh, that couldn't have happened. Well, it did. One of the things I admired for so many years about Williams, because I have all of the things he ever did, and he worked with some of the great writers, African-American writers in the New York area, who, by the way, were an extremely sophisticated, knowledgeable, sharp bunch of men and women.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that all of his material, with no exceptions, transcended the stereotype. He knew he had to work within it. He had to be, on stage, a shuffling black man. But his material spoke to all of us, and he never used the really vicious, stereotypical language. Never. So he was...
Do you think the audience knew that?
I think a lot of them had to, and of course his audiences were essentially white. He worked in the Ziegfeld Follies for 11 years.
Amazing.
This was the top of the business.
Right.
He worked with W.C. Fields and Fanny Bryce and Eddie Cantor and Will Rogers. And these were big white audiences. And I think a lot of them took the stereotype per se, and I think a lot of them began to think about it. And I think he made people think about this. Don't forget, Al Jolson worked in court clear into the late 1920s. Mm-hmm. Think of that. And it was a stereotype and it was accepted, but I think Bird Williams, more than any other single performer in perhaps that whole first 50 years of the century, attacked that in the only way he could, which would be by transcending it.
How did all of this, I mean, you really delved into a lot of things in this process of creating your shows that you do and did, and also that you did a marvelous documentary, I think, for
Mm-hmm. I did a lot of things for PBS, yeah.
Very, very, Mm-hmm. many segments. How did, it had to impact on you personally and on your whole view of the world and of history. As you began to learn so much about this, obviously you were not aware of so much of the history of music, the music that you were playing when you were in radio and at the age of 17. And then, of course, you began to expand. You played jazz, but did it affect you in your playing jazz? Because you are a jazz performer as well.
You mean knowing more and more about the early days?
Yes, the whole evolution of what happened and music. Or was it just music?
No, it was the whole thing. As a matter of fact, I've often said, and I think I have a line in my current press kit that says I'm as interested in Thomas Edison and Teddy Roosevelt Mm-hmm. as I am Scott Joplin and Irving Berlin, which is true. As a matter of fact, I really would not have gotten so interested in the music ragtime as America's first popular music, by the way.
Yes.
Without knowing the context in which it existed and the politics, the morality, the nation, what was going on in the United States of America. And I think we still have to do that with popular arts, with motion pictures, with music. We have to think about the context in which they are created. So I got very interested in that. And, you know, I went back to school. I got a master's at Columbia 10 years ago in American Studies without taking any music courses because I wanted to find out more and more about those things. And as a matter of fact, I'm giving a lecture next week up at Columbia on my friend Finley Peter Dunn about Mr. Dooley. So, yes.
Well, it's changed your life. I mean, you again, we're kind of back where we started, though, but now you're somebody else as well in addition to. You played jazz in some of the sophisticated clubs in New York. I mean, was it jazz you were playing?
Well, by the time I played the old Blue Angel and I played the Village Vanguard.
The Village,
but no, I was doing
were...
ragtime, but I had a group. And I had a really wonderful group. I was trying to point ragtime in the direction of its old use of playing against fretted instruments, which were Mm-hmm. very, very big in those days. Mandolin bands Yes. with 50 guys playing mandolins, you know. And so we tried to do that. But, no, my jazz days go back earlier than that, out in the West and Florida. And, you know, I was a road rat and still am.
Yes, and there's a whole other subject we're going to just touch on, this wonderful book that's been put together by you and your wife.
Oh, thank you.
Who is a marvelous photographer and has been for many, many years. But also you will be appearing at the Prince, is it the Cabaret?
I mean the Cabaret, Morgan's Cabaret. I will be at Morgan's for 2 weeks, 10 performances in all. We're taking a little holiday right around Thanksgiving. No performance the night before, nor on Thanksgiving Day. And I'll be doing the latest version of my one-man show, which we broke in up in New York just this year at the York Theater, which is now under the title Ragtime and Again. I keep changing the title. It's still Marath doing what he does, but there's some different material and people that have seen me around in this area before. It doesn't make any difference. I like to say that I hope I'm right about this, Jill, that the show does not presuppose an interest in period music or presuppose that you should want to hear one rag after another. I think of my shows, I hope I'm right about this, that they are an entertainment and that if I can get you in that seat out there in the audience and you'll say, well, what does this guy do, you know, that you'll be entertained, get some laughs, maybe a few frissons, you know, it's a show.
Well, that is the aim of most everybody in the entertainment business, and
sure
you
is.
Have already achieved it, and I think you will continue to achieve it, doing the things that you're doing. I'm sure the audiences are going to love it. People ask me, who's your favorite composer? Well, that's ridiculous, but Doesn't it astound you that there were so many wonderful songwriters?
Oh, yeah. I would never pick a favorite. Absolutely not. I'd give you 20 favorites.
Well, you like Irving Berlin a lot.
Well, what's not to like? But I also, by the way, I do a Hoagie Carmichael thing in the show at the Prince. There's another person I just... What a remarkable, remarkable guy.
Nothing to play?
Oh, no, it's kind of a sketch. It's not just musical, so
I can't con
you
into playing anything.
You've got to come to the show. Oh, no, if you want
play
me.
Play something else.
I'll play something. Yeah. I'll tell you. You spoke earlier about Joplin's music being quiet and slow. And in the second act, I take the audience back into what I call a time machine, which is a piano, because pianos haven't changed in 100 years. And speak of going to this club in St. Louis, the Rosebud Cafe, where all those great black musicians congregated and exchanged their ideas. And that this might be a medley of some of those Joplin pieces, which, Jill, I call carefully songs, because they had no words, but they are songs without words. They're very lyrical, as opposed to being dynamically syncopated. I've often thought one of the... Easy to say this looking back. I wish he could have worked with one of the great librettists, like James Weldon Johnson or Bob Cole or some of the other, as I say, highly sophisticated, literate black lyricists, librettists. Joplin wrote the libretto for his operas himself, and in fairness, they're not that great. And he... would have been great if he'd written songs. Those, to me, are songs.
They are just, well, you had, what, the Solace in there?
Solace is in there.
And, you know, you played it very interestingly. You added, it's supposed to be a Mexican serenade.
Well, yeah, it's a tango.
But you did that. I always hear it played straight, and you kind of gave it that. It's wonderful.
Well, you know, and I want people to hear that melody. It's so beautiful.
And
if you
race
through it in tempo, you know, a lot of times you get into an argument with the ragtime purists. They say it's in 2-4 and it has no dynamic or tempo changes, so you're supposed to play it. No.
I don't believe that
for a minute, and even if it's true, I don't believe it.
No, it's, I don't know, you're right. But that is a wonderful, again, what you did, it's your soul that's coming through. But you really, really bring the man to
It's music. See, that's the thing. Ragtime is not ragtime. It's music. And the best of it is good music. And I'll leave you with this. One of the things that I discovered in researching this, and anybody that looks into it will find this out, 100 years ago, a black composer that went to a publisher did not get to put down on the page what he wanted. That was true, by the way, of a lot of white composers, too. I mean, oh, this is popular music, man. Take that out. Nobody can play that. Take that out. And you can't put a fermata in there. Nobody knows what that means. Just, you know, we just want to print this. So they were stuck not being able to say, well, I'd kind of like to do a retard here. Take that out. See, so... No, it's on the page. I get to do what I want to with it.
Good. You're listening to Crossover, and our guest today is Max Marath. I'm Jill Pasternak. Until next time.